are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
If you like the stories you hear on the Majority Report, then check out the Sierra Club's new storytelling podcast, The Land I Trust. Season 2 of The Land I Trust brings you 14 storytellers from across the Western U.S. who share their experiences in harvesting, protecting, and living with the four natural elements, with tales of climate change, clean energy, and everything in between. Listen to The Land I Trust at beyondcoal.org/stories or on Apple Podcasts and Stitcher.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, September 18th, 2018. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the 5-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, professor of philosophy at Yale University, Jason Stanley, on his book, How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them. Also on the program today, Kavanaugh and Ford, his accuser, set for public hearing on Monday. The Republicans have caved. The question is, will Kavanaugh cave before then? Meanwhile, a possible second letter by Kavanaugh's law clerks is in the offing as the right wing attempts to smear the professor who was victimized by Brett Kavanaugh as a teenager, allegedly. Trump, meanwhile, declassifies FISA application, Comey texts, other emails revealing only the state of the Trump investigation 2 years ago. Not so interested in it today. And surprise, not surprise, remember when we talked about that tax repatriation bill? Well, it led to CEO pay raises in the form of stock buybacks, not wage increases, and very little capital investment. Also, in the wake of the hurricane, now storm devastating the Carolinas, just coincidentally, the FEMA chief investigated by the DOJ for abusing use of government vehicles. McDonald's workers set to strike today at lunch in various cities around the country, and the U.S. will cap the number of refugees in this country to the lowest level it's been capped since the program began. Good news, Trump won't call you on your cell phone until October 3rd. That was pushed back. And meanwhile, Trump voters may not vote in the midterms because they believe Trump. And lastly, Trump's penis reportedly looks like Toad from the Mario Brothers. Tried to deliver that in the exact same style as any other report, because that is the world that we live in today, ladies and gentlemen.
No problem there.
Look, there was a lot of controversy about that during the primaries, and we clearly did not get the full story. But more on that as the show progresses. I know people are very excited to hear more about that.
And we're very able to cover that.
Honestly, when I read that, I was like, I don't want to do this, but it'll make Michael happy, so we'll talk about it.
Not just Michael.
Well, there you go.
There's a lot of popular support for covering that story in the office.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, the details are just too rich for our future, you know, bits, basically.
Really evocative.
What's wrong with it looking like a mushroom?
I'm going to go, folks.
Take care. Have a take a day off.
Yeah, I'm going to go. Yeah. I'm going to go.
Matt understands literary language, okay?
I just don't feel that comfortable with this close to Yom Kippur. Okay. So a lot has happened in terms of the Kavanaugh nomination since we signed off yesterday. As I think most people thought, there was no way for the Republicans to ignore this story and not open up hearings, or at least say that they're going to. The Democrats want more time. The FBI, when Dianne Feinstein forwarded the letter to the FBI, all they did was they put it in his packet. There's a file. And they put it in Kavanaugh's file. They did not investigate the claim because they need the president to order them to investigate the claim, to vet this. Now, there can be hearings on Monday without any substantiation. Let it just ride on the accuser and the accused and perhaps the second accused, right? She said there were two people in that room, Kavanaugh and this guy, Mark Judge, who is a really insightful writer. Well, and I said we would talk about him more today. He's becoming more of the issue because Chuck Schumer has now just demanded that if you're going to have a legitimate hearing on Monday, Mark Judge has to be brought in too. He is accused, just like Kavanaugh, to not hear his testimony as to whether that took place or what happened or how to explain the idea that she named these two individuals would be a joke, really. It would be a joke. To also, frankly, not have the FBI investigate this, and maybe it would mean you don't have the hearing for another week after Monday, is also a joke. Because the FBI can maybe look for other people who were at that party and exonerate Brett Kavanaugh, exonerate Mark Judge. In fact, you would think that Mark Judge would demand this. I was not at the party, he says. I don't know how he knows he was not at a party 35 years ago. Like, I don't know what parties I wasn't at in high school. That where nothing took place. Now, maybe
5 years ago, or
maybe he's
ago,
an extraordinary yeah. individual and has cataloged all of the parties he did not attend to. And that's why he can't remember things like Kasowitz. What firm that my best friend works at? I don't know. Maybe that's why, it's because he's got so much information about all the parties he didn't go to when he was in high school.
He's got really bad FOMO.
Right. It's very, maybe that's what it is. But nevertheless, it would be a service to him if they want to do a serious look into this. Personally, I don't think that Kavanaugh is going to make it to Monday. I don't know if it's going to happen on Thursday or Wednesday or Friday, but he's going to say this is going to be too much for my family. Because, well, not just because of that, but look, there was a lot of work done to make Brett Kavanaugh seem friendly to women in the run-up to his hearings. Part of that, I think people assumed, was because, a guy who has this much respect for women, he won't take away their bodily autonomy as a Supreme Court justice. But I think there's also another explanation. There may be more of this out there. And one of the areas that it was a problem for him was that Kavanaugh was a clerk of Judge Alex Kaczynski's. In fact, not just a clerk, but was a mentee of Judge Alex Kaczynski's. In fact, Kavanaugh hired Judge Alex Kaczynski's son as a clerk for him. And in fact, Judge Alex Kaczynski functioned as a feeder for clerks for him, not just his son. So they had a very close relationship. But Kavanaugh worked as a clerk in that office. And somehow, he didn't see anything that was going on there. Now, Ryan Grimm, who broke the story about the letter to Dianne Feinstein, has broken another story where reportedly another lawyer who represented clerks in the Kaczynski case, came out with a charge against Kaczynski before any of Kaczynski's of these accusations were proven correct. Right? Like that he had stored a bunch of pornography on his computer at work and was asking clerks to look at it with him. I guess just so that you know it when you see it, right? But so this lawyer, when he was when he made this charge, he was considered, everybody thought he was a loon, and then it turns out to be correct. Well, this lawyer also apparently contacted Dianne Feinstein and Chuck Grassley in July. He has clients, federal judicial clerk clients or former, who want to speak about what Kavanaugh knew and what Kavanaugh, another issue with Kavanaugh. We don't know the contents of that letter. We just know that it exists. And Senator Mazie Hirono, during the hearings with Kavanaugh, I believe was the only person to bring this up. Now, she brings this up with a lot of judicial nominees. But this story about Kaczynski was out there. And here she is questioning Brett Kavanaugh. Remember, Brett Kavanaugh, who can remember he wasn't at a party in high school, but cannot remember the name of the law firm his best friend works at. And I mean, so this guy's got some intricacies to his memory capacity.
Senator Hatch asked you if you were on this Easy Rider gag list, where Judge Kaczynski would send inappropriate materials. Your response was that you don't remember anything like that. Are you telling us that you may have received a steady diet of what people on the list have described as, quote, a lot of vulgar jokes, very dirty jokes, but you don't remember it?
No, I don't remember anything like that, and I'm not.
Oh, the answer is no. Have you ever?
If I could elaborate.
I think that's a complete answer. Let me go on. Have you otherwise ever received sexually suggestive or explicit emails from Judge Kaczynski, even if you don't remember whether you were on the gag list or not?
So, Senator, let me start with no woman should be subjected to sexual harassment in the workplace. And
Judge Kavanaugh, you already went through all of that, and I will get to your perspective about making sure that women in the judiciary do not get sexual harassed. I just want to ask you, during and after your clerkship with Judge Kaczynski, did you ever witness or hear of allegations of any inappropriate behavior or conduct that could be described as sexual harassment by Judge Kaczynski?
No, Senator, and you know there were 10. I worked in Washington D.C. There were 10 judges in the courthouse with him in Pasadena. Prominent federal judges in the courthouse with him, and worked side by side with him day after day while he was Chief Judge of the Ninth Circuit.
To be clear, while this kind of behavior on the part of Judge Kaczynski was going on for 30 years, it was an open secret. You saw nothing, you heard nothing, and you obviously said nothing. Judge Kavanaugh, do you believe the women who recently came forward to accuse Judge Kaczynski of this kind of behavior?
I have no reason not to believe them, Senator.
So, you know, let me just put this into a context, because you have testified that you basically saw no evidence of this kind of behavior at all. You never heard of it. But you worked closely with him on a number of projects. It wasn't just during the time you were clerking for him. You kept in touch with him while you were in the White House. He introduced you to the Senate at your 2006 nomination hearing, and he called you his good friend. Yesterday, you called each of the people who introduced you a friend, and I presume you felt that way about Judge Kaczynski when he introduced you in 2006. You joined him for panels at the Federalist Society, where you patted him on the shoulder and said, "I learned from the master about hiring clerks." And I believe I have a photo of that. Here's Judge Kaczynski.
Now, to be fair, he did not say, "I learned from the master about showing clerks pornography." Just, "I learned from the master about how to hire them." So, let's not get ahead of ourselves.
Women should not be harassed in the workplace, Senator.
Just lastly, the status of that letter is the thing to keep in mind. if there are other people who come out with charges, it will there will definitely not be a hearing on Monday. That is for sure. If they anticipate other people coming out with charges, there will not be a hearing on Monday. Right now, Mitch McConnell, Chuck Grassley are betting that the pressure that Dr. Ford is under to testify will break her. Not necessarily break her. She will get afraid that maybe if there's enough, you know, who knows what. And we'll talk later in the program about the attempts to smear her at this point, which have failed in a big way. Apparently, there's, unfortunately for this other person, another professor named Ford who teaches psychology. But we will get to that as the show goes on. Folks, you've heard me talk about ZipRecruiter in the past. It is how Brendan, who was out today, probably should have asked him that in the interview, ended up on this show. And so, like, when if you have an employee who maybe plays, you know, who turns in like a very loud hot pot at the during your audio broadcast,
it's tea.
Without being aware that it's like
tea, no, I was aware
large noises implicate a
right.
audio product.
I wanted to coordinate the ding,
folks. There are jobs that send you tons of the wrong resumes to sort through or make you wait for the right candidates to apply for your job. That's not smart. That's like trying to brew something during an audio podcast. But you know what is smart? Going to ZipRecruiter.com/majority to hire the right person. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its powerful matching technology scans thousands of resumes, identifies people with the right skills, education, experience for your job, and actively invites them to apply so you get qualified candidates fast. Folks, I have an ocean of qualified candidates. If you need somebody, a great producer for a podcast, because I can only hire one at the time. That's why ZipRecruiter is rated number one by employers in the U.S. This rating comes from hiring sites on Trustpilot with over 1,000 reviews. Right now, my listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/majority. That's ZipRecruiter.com/majority. ZipRecruiter.com/majority. You know my motto. The best time to look for candidates to hire is when you don't need to. So that in the event that one of your employees says, like, oh, I got to go. And you know how I said about 2 weeks? Yeah, it's actually going to be closer, like 3 days. You're ready to go. ZipRecruiter.com/majority. ZipRecruiter, it's the smartest way to hire. Also, folks, I want to remind you, one of today's sponsors of the program is NewsVoice.com/majority. Very difficult to weed through the news these days and get a perspective on what is reality or even a close approximation of reality. One of the other problems is that we all live in our own little media bubbles, and it's tough to get outside of that. There's a new media company that's come up with their own response to these problems. It's called News Voice. It's a website and app for iOS and Android, which you can access for free if you go to newsvoice.com/majority. Gives you a personalized news feed by aggregating a mix of mainstream media sources, international sources, and independent media sources. But here's the key. Multiple sources are provided for each news story. This is basically how I prep for a show. I see what the story is, and then I get two or three different perspectives from a couple of different sources so that I know I'm filling in every single detail, and I'm getting the slants that will come from depending on who the outlet is. The whole site is fueled by crowdsourcing. You can upvote stories that you think are important so more people will see them. You can add stories to the site, or you can add a source that's missing for a story. It's meant to be a completely open and democratized source for news that lets you get every side of the story. They also have a video interview series featuring guests from Chris Hedges to AOC. Go download the app for free by going to newsvoice.com/majority. We've put the link in our podcast description. If you're watching on YouTube, we've put the link below this video. Check it out, newsvoice.com/majority. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Professor Jason Stanley on how fascism works.
fascist, you may be surprised. People all over this world are getting organized to bound to lose. You fascists are bound to lose. Race hatred cannot stop us. This one thing I know. The poll tax and Jim Crow and greed have got to go. You're bound to lose. You fascists are bound to lose. Are you fascists about to lose? You fascists about to lose. You fascists about to lose. You're about to lose. You fascists about to lose. People are baby color marching side by side, marching across the fields where a million fascists died. You're bound to lose. Are you fascists are bound to lose. Are you fascists about to lose? You fascists about to lose. You fascists about to lose. You're about to lose. You fascists about to lose.
We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program the Jacob Urowski Professor of Philosophy at Yale University, Jason Stanley, author of How Propaganda Works, and his most recent, How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them. Welcome to the program, Professor.
Thank you so much.
All right, let's start with the difference between a fascist system of government and the concept of fascist politics.
So, my book doesn't concern fascist government because I think there's too much diversity among people who use fascist politics to get into power. So, and I'm not a historian, I don't look at government per se, but I am an expert in propaganda and rhetoric. So there are certain techniques that people use to get into power. And those techniques, there's sort of a generalizations you can make about them. You know, you whip up hysteria about foreigners. You whip up nostalgia about a mythic past that never was. And you use that, you represent yourself as a strong man who can protect the people from the threats that you make up. And then and that kind of politics, I break down into 10 different aspects, and I call fascist politics.
Professor, you're describing the 10 elements that one employs, I guess, and tools to develop a system of fascist politics. I want to get obviously deeper into that, but what is the what is the relationship between the fascist politics and the system of government? Is it just simply potentially predictive? Can the rhetoric and like
lead
I say, we'll
policy.
Get into can it and does it make it? I mean,
it does.
Okay, yeah. Explain that dynamic.
And we see it already, right? Because when you employ fascist politics, when you create a kind of fear of and panic, then typically, as Hannah Arendt notes, the fascist politics announces itself by a complete divorce from reality. So, but then when you come into power, you want to keep your rhetoric effective. So, it helps to sort of create policies that keep anxiety going, that keep fear going. You know, you can look in the history of our own country. When Nixon came to power on a law and order platform, he initiated policies that eventuated in a sharp rise in crime, which then enabled him to keep the law and order policy, the sort of panic about non-white crime going, and keep the fascist politics successful. You want to smash mechanisms that bring people together, like labor unions, that bring people together along lines that are non-racial,
for example. So you find fascist movements constantly attacking labor unions, constantly attacking ways of connecting people that are not based on race or loyalty to the leader. You find fascist politics strengthened by a one-party state. So you find movements to a one-party state, breaking down voting, creating mechanisms like gerrymandering or rigging the courts so that you have a one-party state. So loyalty is placed in what Hannah Arendt calls party over parties. Loyalty is given to one political party rather than a multi-party democracy. And then once one party, the loyalty is all to one party and the power is all in one party, then that can be coalesced under one leader.
How much, and again, you know, we will get to these elements, but how much of what constitutes or that relationship between presenting the fascist rhetoric and sort of the fascist politics to get into power, how much, and you've just discussed what a fascist leader will do to maintain a certain level of I guess emotional state amongst those who are susceptible to the fascist politics and rhetoric. How much does the deployment of fascist politics in the course of gaining power have a life of its own amongst the electorate?
That's right. I mean, the employment of past fascist politics doesn't result in a fascist state. There's a lot of damage done to underlying democratic culture. I mean, underlying democratic democracy has two great values: liberty and equality. And at the basis of both of those is truth. So people who are being lied to aren't free. Like, you can't act freely if you're acting just on lies. No one thinks the citizens of North Korea are acting freely. And equality also requires truth, because that requires speaking truth to power. Democracy allows us to have different levels of wealth, but a poor person can speak truth to power. So smashing truth is the main center, is the heart of fascist politics. And when you smash truth in a society, then you lose touch with democratic norms. So that's one huge danger. And another danger is smashing the bonds of equal respect with one another. I mean, think of the effects of the rhetoric. Certain rhetoric to tar one's political opponents and to raise panic and fear about foreigners has now been normalized. You know, it's going to take a long time to recover our democratic norms, to get that feeling of shock again when we hear a politician calling whole groups, members of, saying that, you know, connecting whole groups to rape.
Okay, so all right, let's we will rebroaden it when we go through those elements of fascist politics. You talk about the mythic past. I mean, tell us. But I mean, I and your point is that these politics have been deployed throughout our history at various times. I mean, I just remember Reagan, you know, always talking about going back to a simpler time, I guess, when, you know,
absolutely,
white people ruled unambiguously. Right. But go ahead. But tell us about the idea of a mythic past.
So if you go across the world and you look at these ultra-nationalist movements now, or you look at them in the past, they always have this mythic great past that they hearken back to. The core idea in fascism, this is a chapter in the book as well, is to make the dominant group feel that they've lost something glorious. So fascism takes root at times where people feel a sense of loss, where the dominant group, men, for instance, feel a loss at encroaching feminism. The dominant cultural group, whites or Christians, feel a loss at that other groups get some time in the sun as well. So you create this myth of the past. This myth is like, in the past, the dominant group reigned supreme. The dominant group got all the appreciation and the cultural glory. Men were treated like men and lionized and given appropriate respect. And then you connect people's feeling that they're of anxiety to that loss. And what you do by creating that total fiction of this incredible past when people just by virtue of their national identity or religious identity got treated in a special way, or gender identity got treated in a special way, when you connect that anxiety to that sense of loss and you get people to focus their sense of loss and anxiety on the wrong targets, on liberals, on feminists, on foreigners. And so we find that throughout. We find that in India when it's focused, when the Hindutva movement represents liberalism as coming in with Muslims and colonization and talks about this mythic past, wonderful past of Hindu nationalism where it was just all Hindus. So you find this creates nostalgia. Fascist politics weaponizes our emotions, and nostalgia is a powerful emotion. So if you can get people to feel nostalgic for some entirely fictional thing, then you can get them to feel resentful and angry at the forces that supposedly took that mythic thing away.
So now, I mean, it seems to me that there, in the context of our society, there is amongst, you know, what is statistically Donald Trump's base, right? White males. There has been some loss, right, of status necessarily.
Absolutely. Oh, and when you're on the top of a hierarchy, equality will feel like oppression. Because you are losing ground to other groups. And so movements for equality will look like they're targeting you. Because to some extent, they are targeting you. You know, you've dominated too much of the cultural space of the country.
It's a little zero sum, as
absolutely. Fascist politics relies on a zero-sum mindset. So that's why it has to target labor unions, for instance, which go in the opposite direction. Labor unions say, hey, if the white working class and Hispanic working class and the black working class all get together, they might be able to get a lot more money to get and expand the pie and expand the economy, and it's not a zero-sum thing. So that's why you have to break that. You have to say, okay, there's no solidarity. It's all a war of you against people coming in. It's not that the people coming in or the non-whites will expand the base, will expand the economic pie. There's just one economic pie.
But it's also just not economics, right? I mean, from an economic standpoint, you can expand the pie. But from a social status, there is no expansion of the pie.
Well, you could that's right. That's right. There's going to be a sense if there's you could think of the proliferation of media outlets. I mean, one thing that creates resentment is if you grew up just seeing, for example, white faces on television, and then suddenly you see heterosexual faces, and suddenly you see a few non-white faces, that will feel like loss. But
right.
You know, you can create new media outlets.
Well,
you can create
right.
Your own.
I think
art.
Arguably that is part of the problem, though, right? I mean, so we have a president who's relying, who's, you know, like I was just saying, you know, we talk about the you know, and we can move into propaganda, which is your second element. I happened to listen to the radio yesterday. I caught the first part of Sean Hannity's program, and he started off by saying the big story of the weekend was the letters of Lisa Graves being released. And I was like, Lisa Graves? No, it's not the big story. He's saying he means Ford. He means the Dr. Ford. And no, he was literally the big story of the weekend for listeners of Sean Hannity, who is the lead guy on Fox News and has a direct line to Donald Trump, is the emails from Peter Orszag's girlfriend in the FBI. There's a completely different narrative that is grown up, as opposed to, like, you know, the Supreme Court justice nominee may be torpedoed because of a letter. I mean, that
right.
is a function of that stratification. Fox News was built specifically because there was a lot of aging white males who didn't like what they were seeing on the rest of television.
Great point. Great point. And yet it's not enough for them.
Right.
They want the rest of television to go away.
Right. I mean, so tell us more about that propaganda and the how that plays into this.
Yeah. So you're raising a very important point. I mean, we have at this point a state propaganda mechanism in Fox News, which basically makes salient the things that the administration wants to be made salient, and simply acts like the things that it simply acts like the other news doesn't exist, or relegates it. So by giving something extra salience, you can make people think, of course, that's the most important thing. That's the focus. But those are standard propaganda techniques. And though it is worrisome that we have an arm that is devoted to amplifying the administration's goals, propaganda is in some sense part of every kind of politics. But in the case of fascist politics, what you get is things mean their opposite. So the news is the fake news. So Die Presse is the Die Lügenpresse. You know, the Nazis called the mainstream press the lying press. We're seeing that exact trope come back. The idea is that the veneer of objectivity that the mainstream media uses is in fact sort of itself propaganda, a way of hiding its lack of objectivity. So the fake news, the news becomes the fake news. Corruption and anti-corruption, all fascist politicians run anti-corruption campaigns. Putin runs anti-corruption campaigns. Orban ran an anti-corruption campaign. The hilariously named Law and Justice Party in Poland ran an anti-corruption campaign.
Andrew Cuomo.
All of these are very corrupt administrations. Now, you have to ask, what's meant by corruption there? How did President Trump run an anti-corruption campaign? I mean, it's ludicrous. He ran an anti-corruption campaign because corruption doesn't mean corruption. Corruption means the ordinary order is being displaced by a black man or a woman coming to power. So things mean their opposite.
Is that a unique definition of fascist propaganda? I mean, because on some level, I feel like my job, you know, when I'm not interviewing people, or maybe just in the way that I choose, what people I choose to interview is propagandistic. I mean,
absolutely. Absolutely. You raise alarm when you feel it's appropriate to raise alarm.
Right.
And sometimes raising alarm means using alarming terminology. but you are guided by the truth. You're guided by reality. But what happens in fascist politics, as Arendt says, it's guided by extreme contempt for reality as such, is you're constantly attacking reality, because just as liberal democracy is anchored to truth, fascist politics is anchored to power. And so you're trying to constantly, the aim of fascist propaganda is to displace reality and replace it with yourself. So, you know, the news becomes what you say. Instead of truth, you replace truth by loyalty.
Right. Don't believe what you hear on the news. I mean, like, as soon as you, I mean, as you're saying this, like, everyone can hear echoes of what Trump has said on the campaign trail. I'm the only one who can fix it. Don't believe what you hear or what you read. I'm telling you the truth. Yeah. I mean, literally, he said that.
Yes. And so this gets back to your question about politics versus policy. Arendt tells us that because loyalty is so central to fascism, it's the central thing in fascism. Fascism is about authority, power, and loyalty. So when the fascist leader gets, when someone practicing fascist politics gets into office, they continue with loyalty. Loyalty becomes the primary connection that makes someone a valued member of the administration. So it's not competence. Competence is a threat to the fascist leader. Loyalty is the most important thing. And so you can expect fascist leaders to employ family members, sort of people who are connected to their personal business in positions of power. because loyalty is what matters.
Right, of course. I mean, that's why, I mean, it's almost laughable. I mean, Donald Trump was going to hire for, you know, Mark Kasowitz as the attorney general or something, and his personal bodyguard was going to be the head of the FBI if he had his way.
Right, I'm letting your listeners make a decision about the current government and whether it fits what I'm saying in any way. But what I'm telling you is stuff from, say, Arendt or classical discussions of fascism. Arendt constantly emphasizes this about loyalty. She emphasizes the connection between fascist leaders and mafia bosses.
Mm, indeed. And all right, let's talk about anti-intellectualism, which, you know, this has been, it seems to me, maybe this is a good time to ask this question. The relationship between conservative politics and fascism, because it seems to me that anti-intellectualism has been a staple of conservative politics for almost 30 or 40 years. I mean, you can go back to Gertrude Himmelfarb talking about attacking science, and you can talk about the, you know, the eggheads, as Nixon would talk about, and the nattering knobheads as a way of undercutting, again, a certain objective reality.
So the way I think of fascism on the one hand and communism on the other is that they are endpoints. I think right and left are somewhat nebulous concepts, but it's not vastly incorrect to think of fascism as the endpoint of right-wing politics and communism as the endpoint of left-wing politics. Both threaten freedom in different ways. Communism threatens freedom by imposing a harsh view of equality, like material equality, and fascism threatens freedom by destroying equality and creating just authority and hierarchy with the fascist leader at the head. So it's not surprising that you see connections between ordinary conservative politics and fascism, because it's a sliding scale, and fascism is the extreme of conservative politics. I would say that, however, no ordinary conservative position is itself fascist. So take social conservatism. Social conservatism, Christian religious conservatism, for example, in this country, we owe to Christianity the concept of human rights. And human rights are inimical to fascist ideology, because human rights say all human beings have dignity. And fascism involves an ideology of social Darwinism, of winning. So a fascist politician would talk about winning. He would say, you know, we're winning, and so we deserve, they're losers. A fascist politician might say that someone, even if they're quite admirable, they might depict them as a loser and hence of no value, because they're using this ideology of winning and losing determines your value. And that's inimical to Christianity. But Christian conservatism has strong overlaps with fascism. There's the attack on abortion, the Nazi ministry, powerful ministry of abortion and homosexuality. So you have lots of elements of overlap, but you also have clear elements of distinction.
And maybe I should wait for you to say the same thing about libertarianism, because both of those concepts within the context of the American definition of those is inconsistent maybe with its ideal. Right. Like, I mean, I think there's an argument.
Right.
I mean, if you're going to say that libertarianism would theoretically allow
inconsistent with fascism.
Yes.
It's consistent because of social Darwinism. The libertarians, you know, think value is winning on a free market, and that's what gives you value. So they go for the winning and lose it, the social Darwinism aspect. But libertarians should never move past the level of individual as an ideal. So libertarians should never think that one group has more value than another group.
Theoretically.
Absolutely.
I just want to be clear that when we talk about that in the context of American Christianity and American libertarianism.
Absolutely. But so anti-intellectualism is a feature of conservative politics, but it's also the case that it's a feature of conservative politics that's inculcated in conservative think tanks by conservative intellectuals. And there's a whole sort of conservative cast to the way universities should be. They should have great books programs that teach, you know, the great European thinkers, and any sort of teaching James Baldwin is sort of beyond the pale. So you shouldn't teach other perspectives. You should just teach the sort of dominant conservative perspective. But in fascist moments and even part of regular conservative politics, universities are attacked as bastions of liberalism and leftist ideology.
Let's talk about the notion of hierarchy permeates it. I mean, I can see that in the context of there's a lot of elements that are brought there. We can see it, I guess, in the context tell us about where a hierarchy fits in with fascism.
So the two chapters that come one past each other are Unreality and Hierarchy, and they're connected because in fascism, you need to, as I've been emphasizing throughout, break down truth. You need to destroy truth, and you just need to replace it by myth. And hierarchy is a kind of myth because, to be frank, we all suck in roughly equal degrees. No one group is better than another group in terms of its moral worth or intelligence or anything that bears on moral worth. So when we talk about hierarchies of worth between groups, we're engaging in fiction. We're getting people used to myth, self-aggrandizing myth. That's why economic inequality in itself is very dangerous to democracy, because people born wealthy tend to think that they deserve their birth position. So hierarchy breaks down reality. Fascist politics is all about spinning this glorious myth and then telling you that, you know, foreigners, liberals, feminists took that away from you. So hierarchy contributes to this overwhelming myth that the fascist politician is offering you. Here, you were once great. You are meant to be better. You are superior in these different ways. Nature has made you better. You know, you are fit to rule. Men are fit to be, you know, men are supposed to be, the providers. Women are supposed to stay at home. These are all hierarchies, hierarchies of race, hierarchies of religion. And then that feeds into the fascist myth.
And isn't there also an element of this, too, where it is defining, there's an element of defining what constitutes a form of meritocracy? I mean, you know, one of the things in the context of Trump running, for instance, and we could say this about Mitt Romney, for that matter, too, if we wanted, in the Republican, was the Republicans have made the accumulation of money and of being a CEO, you know, president type of thing, the accumulation of money, almost a moral indicator, right?
Right. That's the social Darwinism at the basis of fascism, that what gives you value is winning in some competition. I mean, at its extreme, this ideology led to the Nazi T4 program, the gassing of the disabled, because some disabled people are unable to compete on an open market. So if you're going to be consistent about that ideology, it can lead to horrible things. But yes, that is a central aspect. But what happens in fascist politics is that a property that's supposed to inhere simply in an individual, winning in a competition, becomes placed on groups. And certain groups are said to be more hardworking, and other groups are said to be lazier. So one thing that surprised me in my research is that across time and place, I found that the out-group is always tarred as lazy, and the in-group is always said to be hardworking.
Let's talk about victimhood. Again, this, to me, sounds, you know, eerily reminiscent of my experience with just the conservative movement. There is an aggrievement that is, you know, sort of at the center, at the core of the conservative worldview.
So you always find, you know, you always find fascist politics at its most powerful when the dominant group thinks of itself as the world's greatest victims. So Viktor Orban in Hungary, the authoritarian prime minister of Hungary, when he hosted the International Conference for the Persecution of Christians in 2017 in Budapest, declared Christians to be the most persecuted religious group on earth. You find Hitler, again, all of Mein Kampf is a dirge about the loss of German greatness and the victimhood of Germans, how Germans are persecuted everywhere. Germans in Eastern Europe are persecuted. Germans have been persecuted by Versailles. It's always victimhood. Russian nationalism, emergent Russian nationalism, Russian glory has been, the Russians have been victimized by Europe, by liberal Europe. So you need, you sort of, if you're listening for fascism, you know, you can hear it in the voices, in the cries of and complaints of supposed, when the dominant group, when the dominant group starts to really seem to believe that they are victims suddenly. And that's what the politics trades on.
Number seven on your list is law and order, but I want to get to number eight because I think this sexual anxiety is really interesting, that this would be a part of fascist politics.
It's always a part of fascist politics. The out-group is always panicked. You raise panic about members of hated minorities marrying or raping, quote, your women, unquote. So the Nuremberg laws in Germany were, in the first instance, laws that forbade Jews from marrying non-Jewish Germans. There were based on the United States' anti-miscegenation laws, which forbade blacks and whites from marrying. So all across the world, the beginning of terrible violence against groups seems to start with tarring members of those groups as rapists. So in Myanmar, the ethnic cleansing of the Rohingya started when three Rohingya men raped a Rankine woman in 2012, and then 5 years of vicious attacks on the Rohingya as rapists. You see this with the Hindutva movement, the tarring of Muslim men as rape threats. So, and what that does, what that move does, is it represents the out-group as disgusting. They're capable of these heinous crimes, and then it represents you as protecting. It elevates the values of patriarchy. You know, it says, well, men, you have to protect your women, which are patriarchal authoritarian values. And then it represents the leader as protecting you from this terrible threat. And of course, intermarriage is a freedom. It's a kind of freedom, and in fascist politics, you're attacking freedom. So you're attacking that freedom. And of course, fascist politics also involves attacks on sexual minorities, homosexuality. So, because homosexuality is a kind of freedom. And so, yeah.
Well, I mean, because when we talk about the idea of that, the sexual anxiety in this context of members of the other race, let's say, are going to rape our women. It seems to me that it's broken down into race in that respect, but it's also broken down into ownership of that. It's like a theft of property. I mean, because I wonder how.
Absolutely. That's patriarchy.
Yes. In the patriarchy, I mean, it seems to be playing such a huge role. I mean, obviously, even this week, when we talk about, in the context of our politics, you know, whether it's the Supreme Court or whether it's, you know, Donald Trump or whether it's, you know, a pushback, arguably the biggest anti-fascist, to the extent that we have fascist politics in this country, the biggest pushback has come largely from women, just statistically speaking. I wonder how much of, I mean, if that's a function of the patriarchy being a reinforcing, or is that just like another element of the hierarchy? I mean, it seems like the sexual anxiety crosses here, and also that the fear of homosexuality is not just about their freedom, but also of their breaking these sort of like gender mores that threaten the established order of the patriarchy.
Absolutely. Fascism is harshly patriarchal. The Nazis were the most extreme anti-feminist government in the 20th century, perhaps. You know, women lost their jobs. They had to stay at home and just have children because patriarchy, I mean, and the literature on fascism is very clear about this. I mean, Adorno's authoritarian personality talks about the patriarchal family because the patriarchal family is the model for the state with the leader being like the father of his nation. And so that gives you the model. Same as the CEO. The CEO is like the head of the patriarchal family, who's just, you know, the person who makes the decisions. So when you get people used to that structure with a man, a powerful man, giving the orders and having ownership over his wife and children, it makes you or CEOs simply bossing around their employees. It gives you the fascist structure, a leader who everyone is subservient to, and the people are kind of like his property.
Let's finish on the Sodom and Gomorrah chapter, because that is about this notion like appealing to the heartland. And I also want to take this opportunity to get a notion of the difference between fascist politics and authoritarianism. Because when we talk about this appeal to the heartland, I mean, we see this as elitism, and it's the in the context of the United States, it's, you know, there's a problem with coastal elites.
Exactly.
But it also, I mean, this is a dynamic that I 20 years ago was in Cuba and noticed the same dynamic that we see in, like, sometimes in police forces in the United States, which is the police come from outside of the city. They are brought in Cuba. The police were hired from out in the countryside and brought into the city because there's a natural suspicion of the city dwellers. And we even see that in the context of police. You know, you come from Long Island, you come and you work as a New York City cop, and you have tell us about that dynamic and then distinguish the fascism from authoritarianism.
Good. So as I said earlier, I think of fascism is one kind of authoritarianism, with communism being another kind of authoritarianism. I myself am a liberal Democrat, not a small D Democrat. I mean, a small D Democrat. I'm devoted to liberal ideals of freedom and equality. So I'm opposed to authoritarianism in any of its varieties. And fascism is just one variety of authoritarianism. Venezuela is a terrible state. I would, you know, no one should want to live there. But that's not fascist. That's another kind of authoritarianism. The rhetorical differences there are rhetorical differences. Fascism is strictly hierarchical, and the hierarchy is based on race and gender. Communism is the opposite. It sort of says, no, we're going to flatten everyone, and there's going to be no hierarchies in terms of its rhetoric. Of course, people just use that to sort of loot and steal too often. But so both are forms of authoritarianism. And my book is about fascism, fascist politics, because I think that's the threat that we in this country more realistically face.
All right. Well, let me just ask you this just as a clarification on that point. Does fascism necessarily have to be authoritarian, a form of authoritarianism? Because it seems to me that communism, like, you can have a decentralized communism, right? That's an economic mechanism. It is the case that in instances where we've had communism, at least broadly speaking, in major countries, it has devolved in that way. But it's not.
Agree with that.
Okay. I just want to clarify that. Okay.
I agree with that. My expertise is on rhetoric. So I'm looking at people who use rhetoric I think some of communist rhetoric is quite, you know, attractive. I mean, I'm into equality. So, but then, you know, what happens in a number of these states is despotism results, and the despotism is the authoritarianism.
Fair.
But yeah, fascism is by its nature authoritarian, because it's about power. It's about, people ask me, well, does such and such fascist leader have these horrible beliefs? It doesn't matter. Fascism is about gaining power and using racism or whatever to gain power. So with respect to Sodom and Gomorrah, that was one thing that surprised me. Like in Mein Kampf, the first chapter Hitler talks about is an idyllic small town in Vienna, in Austria, and the second chapter is called My Time in Vienna. And it's all about how Vienna is overrun by foreigners and Jews, and more Jews. And what I realized is that in so many countries, the hated minority lives in the city. And then, like with shock, I realized that the expression inner city in American English is a code word for where black Americans live.
Right.
And, you know, in Europe, the cities were code word for Jews. You know, the cities are so purity is very important in fascist politics. As Tucker Carlson recently said, I don't like illegal immigrants because I don't like litter. So that's a very fascist statement. Like purity is this huge thing in fascist politics. And the cities are represented as dirty places where the hated minorities live, where there's homosexuality. That seems to be fairly universal.
Okay, so with all this said, and we didn't hit every single point, but what, how does one combat a fascist politics? And is that distinct from how one combats fascist, like, institutions and government?
So, fortunately, people who've lived through previous times have given us great instructions, like instruction books, like Arendt's Origins of Totalitarianism tells us what to look like, what to listen for. And I've used some of her wisdom in my book and in this conversation. But there's also apropos the what to do question, the poem on the side of the Holocaust Museum by Martin Niemöller. And it tells us two things. It tells us who the targets of fascist politics and fascist ideology are, and it tells us what to do. So it says, first they came for the socialists, but I was not a socialist, so I said nothing. Then they came for the trade unionists, but I was not a trade unionist, so I did not speak. Then they came for the Jews, but I was not Jewish, so I did not speak. And then they came for me, and there was no one left to speak for me. So what does this poem tell us? It tells us, in the first instance, who the targets of fascism are. The targets of fascism are socialists, that is, leftists. Fascist politics always involves painting ordinary center-left politics as socialism and communism. So the targets are socialists, the targets are labor unions, and the targets are minority groups. And secondly, it tells us what to do. Defend the targets of fascism. Even and especially when you're not in the groups targeted, you have to defend them when they're being attacked, because small amounts of courage early on will prevent the necessity of impossibly large acts of courage later.
And how is that? Is that distinct from what you need? Or is it just simply too late once you're in when you're fighting the fascist politics? Is it too late once you start to see those fascist programs?
No, I don't think it's too late. I think it's in the case of the United. I mean, one thing that I was actually surprised to find is this point about labor unions. Like Du Bois emphasizes it in Black Reconstruction, that the destruction of labor unions was the aim. Because blacks and whites were starting to come together in labor movements. So defend labor unions. You know, that's something that everybody can do in their workplace. Defend when you feel people employing tactics, you know, trying to make you feel disgusted by foreigners or immigrants or panic or fear, resist those sentiments. Go out and volunteer in groups to protect undocumented workers. Resist at all times the feeling of relief that you get that you're not a target, because we know from history that basically everybody gets to be a target at one point or another.
If the antidote on some level to fascism is strengthening the bonds of institutions and of a sense in society that break down supposed differences, Would it also not be the case that a breaking down class distinctions that are, you know, also, I mean, fascist policies, you know, will obviously necessarily provide the rewards to a narrow few, right?
Exactly. Would not
breaking down those things that create class differences, money, and
absolutely, and absolutely, because large economic differences feed the fascist flame. Large economic differences create resentment. And we know from the history of political philosophy that when you have a society riven by resentment, that's something that demagogues can exploit and they can misdirect. So Du Bois talks about this in Black Reconstruction, calls it the psychological wage of whiteness. Wealthy whites in the North, northern industrialists and white planters, made poor whites feel that just by being white, they had won something. And so they set them against people with whom they had common class interests, namely poor blacks. So eliminating, you know, when people feel precarious, you know, Arendt talks about this too. Fascist politics atomizes people. It thrives when people feel precarious, when they feel fearful, when they feel anxious. So instead, and they do so characteristically when they feel economically anxious. So, or jealous or resentful. So what you do is then you make them feel that you misdirect the resentment. You make them think that the targets are minority groups rather than the people who are actually, you know, taking money from them.
Jason Stanley, the book is How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them. Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it. Fascinating stuff. And we will put a link to your book at MajorityReportRadio.com.
Thank you. Great discussion.
Bye-bye. All right, folks, going to head into the fun half. Just an update on our app. We got rejected by Apple because we had a button that says become a member on the app. So we're going to put the app back up without a means in which to become a member. But that app provides you some services if you are a member. And it will be... we'll probably get that thing live in a couple more days. Once we say we'll not give Apple 30% of our membership fees, but we will also defer to their ability to keep a closed system and just make a mental note that when we start having the antitrust hearings in 2023, that Apple's closed system of app charging will be one of the things that we put on the list. So just keep that in mind. Whoever that guy is, Cook, is it Cook?
Yep.
With all due respect. But, folks, in the meantime, you can, because the web has not been completely taken over yet by Verizon. Of course, we will have to deal with that in 2023 as well. Or 2021.
I don't vote out of fear.
We will change those net neutrality rules and whatever membership fee that Verizon is hitting up from your web or AT&T, we will deal with that as well. In the meantime...
Competition would start kicking in.
what was it?
Competition would start kicking in.
Oh, God. In the meantime, you can go to jointhemajorityreport.com to support what we do on the daily show, and you will get as a thank you extra content every day, as well as those features that are on the app in terms of searching the archive and IMing when that is live. Jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. And you can get the Majority Report blend. Today is a Tuesday. On Tuesdays, what happens is the sun goes down and then it becomes Tuesday night. And on Tuesday nights, the Michael Brooks Show happens.
Yes, indeed. Alona Minkowski crew, she's joining us in studio. We are talking about Joe Rogan, South Africa. He's going on the white farmers being killed bandwagon.
Just asking some questions.
And we're going to need to deal with that. Wealth and socialism, whole bunch of stuff that we're going to be dealing with. I'll just leave it at that. Tonight, 7 p.m., we're live. Check out, check out the Michael Brooks Show YouTube channel. A lot of clips. There's over 70 clips up now at this point.
And the Antifada.
Yeah, so we dropped a scorching hot bonus this week from our Jake Flores session, where he talks about our pal Joe Rogan and chasing him around LA.
Complete Joe Rogan obsession all of a sudden.
Oh, well, there's quite a lot to work with there. We talk about Elon Musk on Joe Rogan. It's a good bonus. We also have an episode coming out later this week with the writer David Kleon. We talk about Russia from a leftist perspective. We talk about the recent primary results. And we have been doing more bonus content for our patrons. So I really want to encourage everyone to sign up, check it out. I really cannot recommend this enough, especially in light of some thoughts that were running through my head just now during the interview. Sean did a bonus on historical materialism and how it helps us really understand in a complete way things like fascism and capitalism and how we get rid of those things and where they come from. So, yeah, check it out.
And Matt, the Literary Hangover?
Yeah, Literary Hangover. We're doing a breakdown of Joe Rogan's best appearances on
Oh, shit.
Scarlet Letter, me, Alex, and Kara break down the Scarlet Letter, or as the alt-right subtitle is called, The Vengeance of a Cuck. And actually, I'm approaching 100 members at patreon.com/literaryhangover, and when that happens, I'm going to start narrating public domain audiobooks of books that haven't been read yet for LibriVox, and members are going to get the first listen to those chapters.
Wow, that's, I don't even know what...
That's a fucking great point.
That's
a fucking great Patreon offering.
All right, folks.
That's a fucking good point.
Okay. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, your calls, the fun half, all that and more. Oh, I should just tell you a programming note. Tonight is Kol Nidre. Oh, let's try that again, Matt. Tonight is Kol Nidre. It is the end of the 10 days of awe when you look back on the past year and move forward. Having addressed your sins, apologized, sorry, folks, I apologize.
Yeah, I was going to say, where have you been?
But yeah, and
you should be pretty much prostrating in front of us for at least a week.
Well, you don't have to do that. It's just Yom Kippur. I'm going to fast tomorrow.
Jesus, stay away from us,
Michael. Well, I will. I'm actually that's my point.
I know this is good. Yes,
I will be out of work.
You up.
I will be fasting at home.
Your blood sugar levels.
Oh, yeah. There's going to be a lot of napping and arguing with the kids. That's basically what it comes down to.
So
I will be back on Thursday. Michael will be here tomorrow. See you in the fun half, and Shana Tova.